motivation, start with the motivation for why we want to do that. Of course, it's related to neutrinos. Most of this is probably review. It's related to neutrinos already, specifically no couple of the mass differences for neutrinos. And we know about the mixing between the mass eigenstates and the flavor eigenstates. That's all pretty old news, but there's a couple of things that we don't know about neutrinos still. And that's why we want to look at double beta decay. Double beta decay is again, as you all probably know, it's a very rare second order weak process. So it's very, very rare, which makes it very hard to measure. And that's even the normal kind. The sort of exotic kind of neutrino with double beta decay is even more rare. That's what we're really interested in, because that tells us a little bit more about the neutrinos. That tells us about the Majorana neutrino. IUD is a neutrino that's on antiparticles. If you're a theorist, maybe you have some other ideas what it might tell us. But that's the usual explanation if we use neutrino with double beta decay. It tells us about it tells us about the absolute mass of the neutrino. So all we know is the mass differences from the oscillation experiments, or the mass difference squared. So tell us the actual, and to some extent, the mass hierarchy on the layer. So again, there's two types of double beta decay. This is the sort of mundane type, although it's still very rare and hard to detect, and hasn't been detected, in fact, in xenon up until now. This is just you emit two electrons and two antineutrinos. And then there's the kind that we're interested in that may or may not have ever been observed, which, of course, you emit two electrons and you emit no neutrinos, which means that the neutrino must be its own antiparticle, i.e. a Majorana neutrino, not a Dirac neutrino, and the mass is not zero. And it also allows us then to go ahead and measure that mass. So how do we measure the mass? We measure it by looking at the half-life of the decay. And the half-life of the decay is related to this effective mass in nu already. It's n beta beta sometimes. Times some nuclear physics. This is just the nuclear physics. This could be calculated. Maybe, arguably, you can argue about how well it can be calculated, but at least in principle, it can be calculated. Okay, so where this n nu thing is basically it's the sum over, so it's a beta decay, we're emitting electrons, so it's the sum over the electron component of each of the mass eigenstates with the CP phase factor in here. So these are the two mass splittings we know about. There's a small one and there's a big one. So then zero is somewhere. We don't know where zero is, but zero is down there somewhere. So if the electrons live in these two states, and they mostly do, there's not much electron complement in the third mass, then we can either have this situation, there's a hierarchical arrangement, or the inverse hierarchical arrangement, where the electrons are in the higher mass states. So if the electrons are in the higher mass states, even if this mass is zero, then the effective double beta decay mass is not zero. It's something higher, and so that brings us to this line. So this is the inverted case where as a function of the minimum mass, the effective mass is not going to zero, this is something else. And so if we can measure this half-life to a few tens of millielectron volts, then we can get below this inverted hierarchy regime, and maybe say we can say something about whether or not the neutrino is an inverted hierarchy or a normal hierarchy. Unfortunately, the CP phase is canceling over in a normal hierarchy, and that's maybe zero. And we'll never see it again. It is my anomaly. Now, a lot of people like to show this slide. It looks really nice. You can see where we are here, maybe, if you do the right measurements. Except there's a big punchline that's often left out is that this minimum neutrino mass is not observable in any way. What actually is observable is maybe the sum total of neutrino masses that can be done with WMF and Planck experiments. This number is actually moved over recently. This is the current limit or observation thing. I'm going to look at it on double beta decay mass. What else is observable is the tritium decay mass. And so there's some constraints from that. Unfortunately, this all starts to get more muddy once you look at it this way. So you can't really pinpoint you're in the inverted hierarchy. What you can do, though, if you see a mass down here, is you can say you're not in the inverted hierarchy. Even if you don't see something in another oscillation experiment that shows inverted hierarchy, then you can say that it's definitely a Dirac neutrino and not Majorana, because we were assuming that it wasn't. So there's still some nice things that you can say. Okay, so where are we going to look for this double beta decay? You can only see double beta decay if the standard double beta decay is inhibited, because it's a background to the double beta decay signal. So you have to have a situation where a single beta decay is energetically forbidden, and then you can look at the double beta decay without being swamped by a single beta decay signal. That leads you to a limited number of isotopes, and these are, I'm not sure all of them, they're certainly the prime candidates because they have high energies. So why reach your xenon to work with? There are several that are being used. which is xenon, because it has reasonably acute value that gets you above a lot of the natural radioactivity in background, because there's nothing to really distinguish double beta decay signal from anything else. So you really just have to, backgrounds just have to go away for the most part. There is an exception to that for us to get to. It's relatively easy to enrich. It can be purified and repurified. It's reusable. It can be used in both liquid and gas phase. You can make different experiments with different technologies that have different advantages. It has no long-lived isotopes, which means that the cosmic rays will not activate radioactivity within your material, which will cause a background coming from the material itself. So that's bad. And this is not for XO200, which is what it talks about. It's for XO4, but the beta decay product, the barium, stays in an ionic state, which means that you can electrostatically grab it and actually look for it, and that will reduce your background tremendously because then you really don't have that barium you have to carry. Okay, so unfortunately, again, this is really hard to decay rate. If you want to measure something at tens of millielectron volts to get below that inverted hierarchy, and let's say you only want to have five, you only require five counts a year, which is still pretty hard. You still need nearly 10 tons of xenon to do that with this decay rate. So that's a lot, and that's expensive. So it's hard. Competition is already people working on this. There's germanium extension 6 experiments, the Heidelberg Moscow experiment. I think this is already only part of the Heidelberg Moscow collaboration. This is their claim to signal. A lot of people don't believe it. It's a little controversial. The uncertainty goes down in proportion to time, and the number of authors also goes down in proportion to time. So you can make that what you will. But there's enough people in the community who are skeptical of it. There's a lot of other experiments going on still to measure that. Cortino has already now data released in February on tellurium-130. And they're already down in range that's of 190 to maybe 700 electron volts. It's competitive with the germanium data. And in fact, depending on what nuclear physics you put in there, there's a nuclear physics factor. They might be able to say they can rule it out, it's sort of too sigma, but it's still not as clear as we'd like it to be. And the Heidelberg people would just say, okay, nuclear physics is a little different, not understood in the same way for tellurium and for germanium. We don't want that claim to be something that can still be made, so we're going to push this farther down. There's really no question. And XO200 will come in well below both these measurements. We'll have a 5 sigma sensitivity to this claim. There won't be any question at that point. It's useful anyway, because there is different nuclear physics in all these things. We went across check it, that's understood. There's different nuclear physics in each of the isotopes that's being measured. And there's certain scattering models that's used for that. Primary measurement techniques. Of course, you need lots of material. We need to reduce the background, I've mentioned that, which includes controlling cosmogenic activation of materials when they're above ground. Cosmic rays will activate metals and they'll continue to decay when you take them to your detector site, and that makes backgrounds. You need passive shielding for the backgrounds in the environment. We build the detection system, of course. Active shielding to veto on cosmic rays. High resolution always improves the background. You can resolve the peak you're interested in from the peak you're not. Spatial tracking means you can look at single site events which we're interested in, discriminate those from maybe 2 gamma hitting your detector at once in different places. And finally, XO full, which again is a little outside scope of the stuff, but I'll continue to mention it. You can, if you have some extra mechanism to really identify your particular decay, then that's great. Then this gets very tight. So the plan for XO is we build XO200, which is this 200 kilogram device. This will not be very low electron volts. So there's something, as I showed, about 0.1 to 0.2 electron volts. But this is just a prototype experiment, basically proof of principle. At the same time, we'll be developing a barium tagging work. And once all of that is developed, we can make a maybe 10-ton scale larger detector to go down a little bit inverted hierarchy. In the meantime, though, we do have scientific goals for XO200. We hope to actually get something out of this. I expect the results. We'll see the turnitin decay that's never been seen before. That helps constrain nuclear physics a bit. That's never been seen in xenon. And we'll test very well the Heidelberg evidence to see whether or not that mass really is the Heidelberg scale or not. That'll be the end of that question. Fast facts. I think I've already covered most of this, and anything that I haven't covered, I'll probably go over. well, I just say, so the actual exo detector is a time projection chamber. It collects charge in an XY plane. You can see the XY dimension from that. You get the Z dimension from light. It gives you a timing start. You can see how long it takes to get the charge grid come back there. So the real punchline of this talk is that a lot of this stuff actually exists now. It's here 2 or 3 years ago, and this was all just drawings. So now we can go through the fun part and show you what exists. We need a space to put things in an Activito system, clean rooms, lead shield, shield primarily thorium from the environment, a cryostat to cool down the xenon, and we need a detector chamber, of course, and xenon, so we do all those things. So this is the clean room. This is still drawing stage, but look at the pictures. Lead shield, cryostat, copper cryostat, this is the detector chamber. So that gives you sort of an idea what things look like. But this gives you a better idea of what things look like. Oh, yeah, and the xenon. So we have our 200 kilograms of purified. This is 8% enriched xenon, which is really highly enriched as these experiments go. But we have several claims to fame about how much enriched the material this is compared to the experiments. It's a lot more. Okay. So this is the detector site, the waste isolation pilot plant in Carlsbad, New Mexico. This is what it looked like in 2005. It's also what it looked like in 2007. In fact, one year ago, it's 655 meters underground, in New Mexico. But this is what it looks like today. So this is the clean room that we operate in to keep all the salt dust out. This is the staging area where we can go in and change clothes to get our salty clothes off, put on a clean room suit. It's all adjustable supports because the salt moves by as much as a couple of inches a year. This place is basically slowly collapsing, so we have to have adjustable supports to put everything on. This is a view from the other end, again, down the container here. And this is where the actual physics happens, which is why you see where you have to steel supports to support the lid. So this all exists. It's all been installed. This is the same view, but now there's an extra container. It's basically the same as the Gannon container, except for equipment. This is where we take all the equipment in to clean it off before bringing it into the clean room. And the clean rooms are staged. There's 5 stages of HEPA filters. So cleanliness is very important. Here's just a picture of the cryostat with all the plumbing. We have refrigeration. There's refrigeration plumbing to cool the cryostat. There's plumbing for the heat transfer fluid, which just fills the cryostat, because it's done with dust. There's plumbing for the xenon that goes in, and there's plumbing for all the electronics that goes in. So this is the effect in the middle of it. Photos of it. Of course, we choose very pure copper that doesn't have any radioactive contaminants within it to cause backgrounds. And that's a very large effort that I'll talk about. But after doing that, you don't want to then just get dirt on it. So we take it into the staging area. This was actually the Stanford room that was first installed in the clean room. This wasn't with. And stayed in the corner of the cold winter. But so it was rinsed with nitric. Everything's rinsed with high purity nitric acid to make sure to pinch off any contaminants that may still be on it. So here is the inner cryostat, the outer cryostat, the temporary door again. This is actually inside the cranium, sitting on the windshield. There's someone inside actually taking samples to see if there's any residual contamination inside the container. See some of the plumbing for the cooling filling in here. And this is the super insulation. So this is basically what's used on water gas equipment or on a thermos bottle, either one. Unfortunately, we found out that the super insulation we used was not clean enough. It didn't have a little bit of radioactive contaminants above our tolerances, so we had to change out the whole thing. Which in this tight space is quite a challenge to build this jig to go and pull the whole thing up. But it's done, and now it's good. So this is the lead shield. Again, the lead shield, most of the shields from damage from thorium decays in the solitude whip. All of the lead blocks are interlocked, so there's no straight line of path for any ends. I think there's something like 10 to the 7th, or maybe more, I forgot now. I should know I did the calculations, but it was years ago. But anyway, it's a huge gamma reduction. So even a small gap in this lead shield will basically render that useless. So they're all interlocked to make sure that there's no gaps in. This is the top of the lead shield now, both the bottom foot cryostat set on it. This is the top. The top is in these single one-piece arches with multiple pieces in the Z direction. And of course they're very heavy and have to be installed all in one piece. And you can see it's sort of some piece of work to get it around all the plumbing that you kind of rotate in with this one to the amount of space. The crane is only right here. That's the height of the crane. So that was tricky.
We have 2 more minutes.
Wow. Okay, now I'm just going to show you some more pictures. I think I started 5 minutes late.
Yes.
Okay. So this picture, the detector, it actually goes inside. We have an APD plane that collects light that gives you the start signal, a high voltage plane being at grid wires. Everything is done cleanly and to conserve as much xenon as possible. These APDs are really novel. We've tested those. Flat cables, waste as little xenon space as possible. This is the actual detector being welded. Even the welds have been tested for radioactivity. Background control, we've studied literally hundreds of backgrounds. There's a paper on it now from thorium, uranium, various cosmogenics. So we have light detection systems to look for those. Neutron activation, ICP-MS, direct cam counting. Everything is Monte Carlo, all the backgrounds are Monte Carlo simulated. Every piece that goes in the detector must be tested for background contaminations. Monte Carlo simulation is done to see what background that will actually produce in the detector. For every single one, this is the cables, the simulation of cables. And this is the copper shielding to make sure that this is the copper transport shielding to make sure it's not activated for cosmogenic activation while it's above ground being worked on. It's always kept inside concrete. The neon veto system is obtained from carbon. And so these are some of the guns with photocubes on them to detect the neon veto light. Each one of the photocubes had to be calibrated to make sure they're game matched. So that's just showing single photo electron calibrations. Tubes. And then we got a response function of each veto panel as a function of position. So this is a telescope that we can trigger on a muon telescope. We know it's going to do that. We see, we know we have where the muon is. There's the muon peak from the center of the veto. And then this is the response to the panel as a function of position. We want that to be as flat as possible to give good resolution. But this turned out to be good enough because the backgrounds that we care about are way down here. So the muon veto works. It's been simulated. We can get between 95 to 99% is the simulation. Even 95 to 99% rejection efficiency from that, which is good enough. We only need 90%, so that's what we need. This is the engineer's conception of the detail. This will cover the entire plane room and detector. And to conclude, XO200, after running for about 2 years, will have significantly more mass times lifetime than any detector that exists now. We'll reach micron mass sensitivity in this range in milli-electron volts, 933 to 186 milli-electron volts. And I won't worry about the full XO. So the real punchline, though, is that construction is nearly finished. You've seen all the parts, they exist. We're basically just waiting on the cables to be produced, and the orders already put in those flood cables to be produced. Then we can start taking at least electronics data to test the electronics, and hopefully we'll have technical data in very soon within some number of months, which is not small. Background control has extensive background control, the really systematic background control. You can see that on that. It will allow us to reach these models then with this much mass very easily. So, there's the collaboration. And that's not our collaboration.
Any question?
You said this was the first stage of a, and there's going to be better plans to develop it later. What are the expected?
Yeah, so we're actually going to eventually have a system where we'll have an ion trap. We'll grab the barium out of the thing with a cold tip, which is this structure. So it's the cold tip basically attracts and freezes out the residual barium ion, and then can pull it into an ion trap. Which this actually refers to this thing. This is fantastic. It's the linear trap that we can then see the barium ions and laser tagging. We'll combine that with a much bigger detector, especially just making it larger at that point. This will reduce the backgrounds to be detected for your sensitivity. So we don't know exactly, but maybe 10 tons, something in that range.
Any more questions? Well, then, Mr. Thanks for